in this episode.
Because by not having that understanding of oneself in there and one's own stories and motives, then it becomes more difficult to lead and empower others. Okay. And to understand the full team dance, because sometimes the self can get in the way of that.
Learn to perform. Practical lessons so that you can immediately learn to optimize your health, happiness, and performance. Welcome to another episode of Learn to Perform. I am your host, as always, Braden Ostepchuk, and today I'm bringing on another excellent guest who's going to give a ton of insight into coaching, leadership, and the psychology of success across all sorts of industries, sports, athletics, careers, you name it. So without further ado, let me introduce our guest. Today's guest is Dr. John Yeager. Now, Dr. John Yeager, I actually had the opportunity to work with him briefly at Norris University, so I was able to facilitate a little bit of a relationship in the past. But let me tell you all why he is such a great guest and why he's going to offer so much value to us today. So, Dr. John Yeager, drawing on his illustrious lacrosse playing and coaching career and his organizational behavior work with athletic, educational, and business organizations, John's presentations and training programs have inspired audiences around the United States. As a former elite lacrosse goaltender at the high school, college, and professional levels, he is a member of the Halls of Fame of New England, Eastern Massachusetts, and UMass Boston, Boston State. He was named one of the top 20 New England lacrosse players of all time by the New England Lacrosse Journal. He then translated what he learned as an athlete into high school and college coaching in Massachusetts and Indiana. Extending his interest beyond the playing field, he became a certified polarity thinking consultant after graduating from the country's first graduate level applied positive psychology program at the University of Pennsylvania. In addition, he also earned previously his doctorate at Boston University. These experiences combine to give John a unique understanding of the needs of coaches for continuous learning. John is also the CEO of Yeager Leadership Group, in which he helps athletic programs, businesses, and schools discover their positive core by maximizing engagement and capacity to develop high-performing teams. His clients have ranged from large corporations to numerous professional and collegiate teams across various sports. And if that's not enough, in addition, John is also the author and co-author of three books, including Smart Strengths, The Parent-Teacher-Coach Guide to Building Character, Resilience, and Relationships in Youth, Our Game, The Character and Culture of Lacrosse, and Character and Coaching, Building Virtue in Athletic Programs. He has written for SportsIllustrated.com and has been quoted in the New York Times Magazine and Sports Illustrated Magazine on matters of character and youth sport. And now John has a fourth book coming out, which is called The Coaching Zone, and something that we are going to be able to dive into in more depth in this interview as well. So John, I apologize for the long intro there, but you've got an impressive resume and there's a lot of content on there, but thank you so much for taking the time with me today.
Thanks, Braden. It's great to be here and I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. And you know, just to tie back in, I quickly mentioned it at the start, but we obviously met a couple years ago at Norwich University. It might've been 2017 was the first year, maybe 2016. I'm not exactly sure.
2016. Yes. And then online, was working with the team online, then got a chance to see you folks in person.
Right. Yeah. And I do remember that very well. And you helped our team a lot and we had some great experiences. And I think we're going to be able to get into that a little bit later. And before we get into this, so I was able to lay out a little bit of your background on lacrosse as a player and as a coach and your coaching, Yeager Leadership, the books that you've written. But before we get into this, I think to really lay the framework and kind of set the tone for people, there was this wonderful story I remember when you came out to Kreuzberg Library and met with our team that you told about. It was at Middlebury and it was when you were playing lacrosse. And I would love if you would maybe just start off by telling that. And I think it could kind of set the tone for, you know, or the foundation for what we want to build off of in this interview.
Certainly, Braden. For me, it was a life-changing experience. And it's actually a good story to it. It covers all the elements of what a good story should be.
Right.
And it really follows an area that I will be talking more about today called psychological capital. This was psychological capital, which was developed by Fred Luthens at the University of Nebraska, and his colleagues there talk about the notion of there's human capital out there, which is human capital of the knowledge and skills of, you know, coaches, athletes, and teams. Then there's the social capital, which are the relationships. But psychological capital is based on four components: hope, efficacy, or confidence; resilience and optimism. And the story about Middlebury is kind of covering all those. I didn't know what psychological capital was back then. But anyways, this happened back in the mid 70s. I'm an older guy here. And basically, I played for Boston State College, which is now University of Massachusetts at Boston. And we had our first home game of the season. Very excited about our first home game. One is that we had a pretty good team. And secondly, I was hoping for an opportunity to maybe garner some Division III All-American honors. And the coach of the other team, Bowden, and he was on the All-American Selection Committee. So with that, I was pretty anxious, but pretty excited about getting, you know, for the game. So got out there, had a good warm up, and played absolutely awful.
I've been there.
The game, something like 16-4. I wish the coach could have taken me out, but the other goalies weren't ready for prime time, so I was stuck there. And so basically got back to my dorm, had to grieve for a couple days, so I didn't end up going to classes, which was not a good excuse. But Thursday of that week, we were playing Middlebury at home, and that was a chance for redemption. And so I got in the car with my friend Danny Hayes, who was a freshman, and we started driving over to the field. And our field, Smith Field, is located in Brighton, Massachusetts, right on the offside of Harvard University's athletic complex. You could see the Coliseum there, the pristine green fields, and we were separated by a chain link fence and razor wire on this dirt, glass strewn, three blades of grass field that we called our home field. And it was a 3-mile drive over from campus. Anyways, trying to get over to the game, we couldn't get out of Boston because it was Red Sox home opener. So it was gridlock with people and cars. We finally show up to our own home game an hour late. And so, therefore, I'm getting pretty anxious about that. Concerned, am I going to have a game that I had like the last time? Am I an imposter? And Middlebury's out there, and their head coach, Rob Pfeiffer, who's a big guy, looked ex-military, had a high and tight haircut. He's barking out instructions. They're having very organized drills. And you picture them, and you picture us, and we're a bunch of scraggly hippies with long hair. And it goes, so picture me with long hair, brown, parted in the middle. You know, headband, you know, with the peace sign. That was us at that time. And first shot of the game, Middlebury takes, and it goes in. It goes over my shoulder. It's a really good shot, but the goal ball went in the net. So I'm starting to think, okay, it's okay. Just settle down. We'll be all set. And as a goalie, you know, understand how important it is to save the first shot.
Absolutely.
You know, and so the second shot comes in, and it goes 5-hole through my legs. And suddenly in the back of my mind, my monkey mind, or my drunken monkey in the back of my mind, is starting to say things like, you don't have it. You are an imposter. You know, this isn't going to work. And I said, I had to work myself through that. And fortunately, when Middlebury got the ball again, they had one of their players come directly down the field, suddenly dodged by all our defensemen, and took a shot on me point blank. And I kind of guessed, and I put my stick low, and it went right into my stick. It looked really cool. Picked it up, threw it out for a clearing pass, and a couple passes later, we scored the goal. It was 2-1. We're down. Then we went 2-2. We tied it. We ended up winning the game 6-2. So for the next 30 shots, I just felt like the ball was a beach ball. But that's really not the most important part of the story. The most important part of the story actually happened in the second period when Pfeiffer called timeout. He said, you know, timeout Middlebury, and the Middlebury players dutifully ran over to their bench. We went over to the Boston State bench. One of our players on the team, Ronnie and Jemmy, and Ronnie had actually shaved half his beard off before the game pumped us up. So we were a little different, okay? And anyways, Ronnie runs to the Middlebury bench instead of our bench, and we're yelling over to him, and he goes in through the Middlebury huddle. The Middlebury players, what are you doing here? He jumps on the back of the coach of the other team, of Pfeiffer's back. And we're going, oh, this is not going to end well. He comes off the back of the coach. The coach turns around. Ronnie takes his helmet off, half a beard. They look up at each other, and then they both begin to have tears. And these are literally tears of joy, but why are they crying? Right. What's going on? So the backstory, when Pfeiffer called timeout, and Ronnie heard the voice the intonation and the inflection of Pfeiffer's voice. The last time he had heard that specific voice was 6 years before in the jungles of Vietnam, because Pfeiffer was his platoon commander. And everything just stood still there. It was the longest time out of all time. You know, this happened in 1975. It was a long time ago. But today, that ranks as one of the most important events in my coaching, playing, any type of career I had to do with sports. And I know, you know, some of the players that I knew from the other team, I became good friends with them and ended up coaching against some of them and stuff like that. And we'd always go back to that game. And I think that it was kind of a nexus for me, or a genesis of why I wanted to look at and work that I do with Jaeger Leadership, but also as a coach with a variety of different teams over the years, is that talk a little bit about the why. And Drew Hyland, who's a sports philosopher who was at Trinity College in Connecticut, once said, you know, sports can give you a feeling of completeness. And that's what it was, you know, a feeling of completeness of everything was seemed to be aligned there. Now, that can change on a dime. Mm-hmm. Beauty of sports, there's many times there's do-overs, but it really brought out, and it brings out in other people, the why we do what we do and why we enjoy sports so much.
Right. And so you think that that experience helped you discover your why within sport as well, of having witnessed that, you know, incredibly tight bond between two people who literally went to war together and, you know, then ended up later, you know, 6 years later in completely different circumstances on other sides of the bear. But did it help you to kind of realize that there is more to it than simply making saves or winning the game, or more to it than just going out there and playing? And I know we're going to get into psych cap coming in bigger, but how does that also then tie into the role that human psychology plays as human beings, as our whys, more so than just, you know, employees in an organization or athletes on a sports team, or, you know, other examples like that?
Well, in many ways, Braden, the, you know, our team collaborated with each other to play their team, who collaborated with each other. But then we competed against them. But in many ways, it's a big collaboration. Mm. You know, it's like quantum theory, you know, it's just stuff is happening in there. And you're not always sure what's going to happen when you get out there.
Right.
Human element is so important there. And so when you look at these ideas of hope and confidence and resilience and optimism, those are just have really natural homes in sport.
Mm. And in any organization too. So
anything.
Really then when you go through an experience like that, what that is allowing you to do is perhaps see the power of that human aspect. And then, you know, that ends up leading to what you've been working on for so many years and been so successful with, is how can we then understand human nature and human psychology, and how can we leverage that to bring out the best in people and then in our teams and in our organizations and downstream? Is that a fair, high level summary?
Definitely a fair assessment of it.
Okay. Yeah.
The thing is that, like with Pfeiffer, I became pretty good friends with him, mm-hmm. you know, just because of that game. And eventually after he stopped coaching, he ended up becoming an official. And just, you know, when I see the Middlebury guys coaching venues and stuff like that, we'd go back and talk to Pfeiffer about Pfeiffer and he was the coach of the other team.
Right. Okay. So I think this is a good time to make a little bit of a segue then. As I had mentioned in the intro, you're coming out with a new book called The Coaching Zone. And I would love for you to give us a little bit of an overview, high level of the book. Obviously, we're going to dive into a bunch of different things. I know psych cap is an important theme that comes up, but I really like this segue right now because so much of what you talk about in The Coaching Zone, and I was very fortunate, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to read through it in advance, is this idea of understanding human nature, so that how can we leverage that to understand ourselves? How can we understand the people that we're coaching? How can we understand the systems? And how can we leverage human nature and everything that matters most to become more effective? And so I'd love if you could just start off with a kind of a quick rundown of The Coaching Zone, what it's all about, and then we can really start to dive into some key areas.
Well, I was fascinated with the thought leader Daniel Goleman's Harvard Business School Review article back in 2013 called The Focus Leader. And he talked about, to be a focus leader, you need to be able to shift between three different levels of attention. One is a focus on self. The second is a focus on others. And the third is a focus on the wider world. So what I found myself doing, working with different coaches, teams, and athletes within teams in all different sports, is that there this dynamic fits right in there too. And especially for coaches, where coaches need to have a level of self-awareness, okay, and self-regulation. That's that focus on self, you know, kind of a meta approach to that. They also need to have a focus on their athletes, okay, individual athletes, and looking at the individual athletes, you know, as each one being different to a certain degree. And third, having a view at the bigger picture of their teams and understanding what the team dance is, okay, because there's rhythm and flows and patterns. Athletes and teams are kind of are orchestrated by the coach to kind of work in concert with each other. Yeah, so the book is about shifting between those three different areas. You know, first of all, talking about coaching self-awareness. Second, about leading and empowering others. You know, it goes to that, you know, how well does a coach provide direction, but how well does the coach actually empower the athlete? And how do they hit the sweet spot with that? And then looking at the team from a standpoint of taking a look at the individual and saying that the individual is important, but the team is also very, very important. Many people, you know, hear the idiom, it's the cliche, there's no I in team. Well, there is an I in team. There is the individual who develops his or her own skills over time that contributes to the team development in there. And it's hitting the sweet spot there too. And many times when you over-focus on one to the neglect of the other, that becomes an issue with that there. But also looking at teams with accountability and support and the development of culture. And looking at culture, you know, whether it's a kind of culture that creates, collaborates, talks about control or competing. And this is the work that's been done by Kim Cameron and Bob Quinn from the University of Michigan in their competing values framework. So a lot of the things that I take in the book are not necessarily going from the locker room up to the boardroom. It's actually strategies that are used in the boardroom now that can actually now be used. And many times coaches are using that without even knowing it. And they talk about those four different culture drivers. You know, that so if you think of a coach who creates and they're innovative and you know failure is a chance to grow, to be in a growth mindset. But that another coach will be out there in collaborating, will maybe do the creation, but collaborating, the connecting the dots between each of the players. The third is control, paying attention to the little things. Okay, those dynamics. And the fourth is compete against oneself and the team against itself and against their competition. So it looks at a results-oriented achievement. And some coaches and team cultures actually have all four of those working. Some may have three out of the four working. And it's what is the best, you know, set of culture drivers for a team to really flourish in a success-conducive environment.
Right. And obviously for every team and every situation, it could be a little bit different, right? Like you said, you have to really customize and adapt to what maybe your specific needs are. And, you know, when you're describing that, I keep thinking of this very complex system. You know, it's easy, I think, for a lot of people to be quarterback coaches or to, you know, be at home watching the big game and be like, oh, well, that was a bad decision. Why did they do that? But it's, you know, it's not just X's and O's. I mean, it is incredibly complex. And like you said, and as we go back into psychological capital, you are leading people, you are empowering people, and you have to lead yourself. I mean, there are so many aspects of this. It's I when I was listening to you thinking about that, the thing that came to my mind was in many ways you were describing how I like to look at the human body. You know, it's not enough to just look at your nutrition or just your sleep or just, right, you know, your right. cardiovascular system or just your nervous system. I mean, everything works together in this really complicated process, and you really need to try and take a holistic approach to how can we optimize the functionality of everything. So in your time working with a lot of different leaders through sports and in different industries as well, do you find that if we look at those three categories, the self, leading others, and then also leading the world or the greater picture. Do you find that there is one of those three domains that perhaps coaches or leaders tend to lack the most of, or is really urgent? Or do you think it's a pretty even balance between all three, sometimes are hit or miss depending on who you're working with?
I believe, Braden, that self-awareness and self-regulation, that first focus on self is critical. Because by not having that understanding of oneself in there and one's own stories and motives, then it becomes more difficult to lead and empower others.
Right.
Okay. And to understand the full team dance, because sometimes the self can get in the way of that. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important. That's why I talk about this in the first part of the book, so that coaches can get that grounding there. You know, and I always think of somebody going to read the book and they're going to just skip through that and go straight to the strategies. But I kind of emphasize that that's really important to do, is to understand their strengths as well as their blind spots and shortcomings. Mm-hmm. Understanding their story, what are the actions and the insights from their stories that they've had in their coaching lives?
Right.
You know, I mean, for me, it was when I was 11 years old running a road race on July 4th. And I had been running, and it was a 3-mile race. I had never ran 3 miles before. My father took me down to the starting line, and we were preceding the parade that was going to come behind us during the day, somewhere on the running course or parade route, just to cheer on down the road. And I got to sign in, and I saw that everybody else was 16 years older, up to 40. And suddenly I was a fish out of water. I'm 11 years old. I'm this little kid. And I'm saying, like, well, this is wrong. This is not right. And I could feel my anxiety coming on. And I looked over at my father, and my father looked at me and he gave me a smile. And all that the smile said was, you're okay. You can do it. You don't have to do it. You got it. And that kind of settled me at that time. And so the gun went off. The race went off. I finished dead last. The parade almost caught up to me. But the bottom line is, I remember that as if it was yesterday.
Right.
You know, just because it allowed for me to understand, to work through that with some of the psychological capital pieces. And then from that time, working with other people, working with other coaches, to getting them to come to an understanding of where they are. I remember working with a Division I swim coach who at times is very, very, really, really speaks his mind to the team, which is great. And it allows for kind of a free flow dynamic, but at times really needed to be more close up to athletes during their meets, because in many ways, he was finding that he was kind of like so focused on what's next and making sure these other events are happening and stuff like that. He wasn't giving feedback to swimmers pre-race and post-race. And literally, the mantra he ended up having was step forward. Okay, step forward to make sure that he's addressing the athlete there. So this took a good amount of self-awareness for him to work through, but it increased his capacity as a head coach in how the athletes, the swimmers and divers, respond to him in that way. So I think that's critical, self-awareness.
Yeah, I love that. I think it's so important in everything you want to look at. I mean, if you don't have your own house in order, it's pretty hard to have other people's houses in order, right? And just for the people that are listening, and especially all the coaches, I mean, this book can be applicable beyond coaching. So you don't have to be a coach to, take a look at your book and give it a read, obviously. Yeah. But, you know, as I was going through, you have a ton of anecdotes, you have a ton of case studies with different coaches who are highly successful, who've had a lot of experience. You share your own personal stories as well as your co-author. You know, there's frameworks, there's exercises. So just so people know, not only is this going to help, educate you and help you think about things differently, but in many ways, it's also serves as a bit of a workbook and an exercise book where you can work through individually and you can sit down and reflect, where are my weaknesses? Where are my strengths? What is working? What is not working? And it kind of gives you that, tangible, practical application to say, how do I take this into my life, into my coaching or my leadership, and how can I improve it? So I think that's wonderful. And I'll give you a chance at the end to talk more about, how it can benefit people.
But
you brought up, again, psychological capital. We brought it up at the start. I'd love for you, because this really underpins everything. And for example, you're talking about the story of running the marathon. That was kind of when it just, those elements of psychological capital really click for you. And you talked about HERO is the acronym. So hope, efficacy, or confidence, and then resilience and optimism. I would love, if you don't mind, just elaborate a little bit more on PsychCap, why it's so important. And maybe if you have any other examples, you know, that come to mind, just some way to really help build for everyone listening why exactly that matters and what you mean by this.
Well, many times people will take the four components of PsychCap, hope, confidence, or efficacy, resilience, and optimism, and actually bunch them all together. Okay. What I try to do is take them and show them where they have their own natural foundation there. So coaches can see where their own psychological capital is in each of those components. Now, of course, to have those collected together is the best. Where when leaders, athletes, and collectively among a team have PsychCap, then having all four of those components is basically what we try to hope for and look for. But if you're looking at hope, hope is about three components. It's about setting goals, realistic goals. It's about finding pathways to those goals, because if one way gets stuck, you have another direction to go. Okay? And an example of this is a high school basketball coach that I've worked with before, who basically, you know, is able to, you know, shift with the goals midstream in a game. Okay. And is able to find different pathways to get to the goal. And the third part of that, besides goal setting pathways, is agency, that you have the capacity to be able to make this happen, which bleeds nicely into confidence. Okay. And when I think about confidence, I think about Austin Cerulean, who was, your junior year was the senior captain. He was a junior and senior captain at Norwich. And one of the things about Austin, I have PsychCap based on, one is that his ability to shift directions after Norwich had won 18 straight regular season championships this year, Braden, was when you weren't going to do that. Several other teams, Babson and I believe UMass Boston, were going to probably come in first and second.
Yeah, that's correct. I'm pretty sure UMass Boston was first, Babson was second, and we finished third.
Yeah, and it was going to be really hard with the amount of games left to make that shift there. Mm-hmm. And Austin kind of contacted me. You know, we got on a Zoom call, even way back then, on a Zoom call back. And,
right.
and talking a little bit about, you know, what the deal was, and how he was saying that people, you know, around the campus were saying, you know, what's wrong? How can you fix it? Austin's feeling responsible as a captain, but we did some work online with the team. But Austin was able, through his own leadership, saying, hey, we, you know, let's see how we can, you know, finish off the season. And you end up beating those teams, you know, and the, you know, finishing up the season, even though you still ended up third regular and going into the playoffs. But his capacity to do that and be able to echo that to the other players was really, really important. The same thing, he had confidence, where he was able to take mastery experiences that he had had in leadership and on the ice to get there, you know, and he was able to, you know, getting feedback from coaches and being able to be ready for games allowed him to have that confidence. And basically the resilience, you know, when the rubber met the road and there was adversity, he was able to kind of stay right through that. And one of the things that I noticed when I worked in the team with the team in person in the 16-17 season was that Austin commanded a deep amount of respect because of his hope, his confidence, but also being optimistic, where he was able to take an interpretive latitude of where things were and having leniency for the past. This is where we were in the first part of the season. This is how we can finish our season off. And what are our opportunities for the future? Well, as you know, your opportunities for the future is that you folks put together an amazing season in 2016, 2017, and won the Division III men's national championship there, because you put those all together. And it was his capacities to show his own PsyCap that helped to develop the team PsyCap, okay, that helped to develop everybody. So that you folks, the members of your team that year were able to put things together, had pathways to your goals. You were confident, okay, and nothing got you folks down. You were able to work through adversity fine, and you had an incredible amount of optimism. Mm-hmm. It was almost if you had pictured yourself in championship rounds way before it even happened. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty cool. And that's how those are examples of how PsyCap can come alive. They're actually breaking those down in four different areas: at the coaching level, at the athlete level, and at the team level.
Yeah, no, I love that, to just, you know, reliving kind of that story in that time frame, to hear it from your perspective, a different perspective, is awesome. But also to put it in the context of, you know, hero, hope, efficacy, resilience, and optimism. And, you know, first of all, Austin is an incredible guy, and you're 100% right that everyone had the utmost respect for him. And I mean, I've always looked up to him as someone that I've always admired, not just as an athlete, but as a person and everything he does, whether it was right. Seeing the way he worked in New York finance, or whether it was, you know, at school or it was in the gym. You know, the guy was incredible. But, you know, it's funny, you talked about having those four pieces. And if I were to go and break this down, because you're exactly right, I think it was 18 straight years we had won our regular season conference championship every year. And that year, which was my sophomore year, we didn't win it. We ended up finishing third, like you had mentioned. And, you know, it was definitely a different vibe in the room compared to the other 3 years, for sure. Definitely compared to the next year. And I look back at hope, and, you know, hope, was there hope there? There probably was, in bits and pieces, maybe not as strong as it had been. Confidence definitely wasn't the same as other years, because, you know, we were losing games and we did have our share of struggles, and we did have a young team, and, you know, it wasn't the same. And so, you know, from a player on the inside, it's hard to articulate it. It's harder to be aware of it when you're in the moment. But when you look back in hindsight, you know, definitely were we as confident as we had been in other situations? No. So we were probably missing that element. Resilience is an interesting one. It's tougher to go back in time because it's been so long now, but, you know, it wasn't the same where, you know, no matter what, we're 100%, like, it did seem things were a little bit of whack. And then obviously optimism, it kind of, you could see that, okay, is this the end? Like, is the ship going down? And you just, you know, you hear all the voices, you know, around the campus, and everyone like, what's wrong? Like, you guys have won the conference 18 straight years. Like, why are you in third place? Like, heaven forbid, you know, a team's in third place of a conference of 10 teams or anything. But like you said, that next year, you know, we went through major learning, major growth. We had the same leadership group because we only had one senior graduate that year before. So right. We went with Austin, yeah, exactly. The same older guys. And then, you know, we had a few new players come in, but it was largely the same team. Like, there wasn't any major, major changes. But when we came back, and I remember clearly, a good little story from that year that we won. It's, we ended up finishing the year, I think, 27-1-3. So we only had one loss the entire season, and it was in Skidmore, and it was a game in overtime. And I remember when we got back into the room after, there wasn't a whole lot of dialogue, but it was pretty clear that that's it. Like, this is the end. Cause we knew we had a good team. We knew we were there. And for Austin and that senior class, this was their senior year. So, you know, we had this year was a redo after last year. And I remember just that feeling in that room after that game, thinking, I don't think I'd ever experienced in my life a hero elements, thinking about the hope, like, okay, this is it. Like, we're going to win this. This is not going to happen again. Just the supreme confidence that every single night we were going to dominate, and the resilience to push back, you know, after what happened the year before and after losing that game, and just the optimism. When you look at those four elements, I have never been a part of a team that has been so dialed in. And after that loss in Skidmore, we were unbeaten the last 25 games of the year straight until the national championship. And we just, you know, obviously we had a few ties in there and there's some phenomenal competition, but in many ways, I remember every single game, whether I was playing or not, no matter who was playing, no matter where, whether on the road, at home, any team, we knew we were going to win. We knew we were the best team in the country. And at, you know, you just, the way you describe each of those four elements one by one, I think it's a perfect example. So I appreciate you letting me relive that a little bit. I'm getting a little.
Sure. Yeah, well, that's great. Well, that's part of your story, Braden. It leads and helped you as a leader today.
Right, exactly. Wow, you really got me going here. But I did want to move on to the next idea. And one of the concepts that are super, super important in your book is the idea of polarity thinking. So understanding that there are different polarities, and you list a bunch of them, so I can let you talk about that a little bit. But I think it's something that I would love for you to talk about and explain to people, because when we And I know for myself in my own life, trying to self-regulate, when do I need to do more of one thing or pull back on another thing? And how do you find that balance? And this is where polarity thinking really comes in. And you obviously have a lot of academic background as well. So I'd love for you to take some time to talk about polarity thinking.
Well, a polarity is an independent pair. And these could be values or strategic objectives. People have, heard of, yin-yang, light, dark. Basically, polarities, typical examples would be like if you were to kind of run a marathon, okay? And running a marathon, is a lot of activity and training for that, but also a lot of rest so you don't overtrain. And it's, as you said, it's like hitting the sweet spot with that. Mm. If you train just enough and you're getting enough rest, you reach a point where you're probably going to hopefully realize that goal. If you have the capacity to do that. But if you overfocus on one area, one pole to the neglect of the other, then that becomes a problem. Okay. And basically it's about being able to dynamically balance that. You know, if you think about polarities today outside of the, athletic arena, you think about politics and you think about even in political culture now in the United States, take liberals and conservatives, and trying to meet halfway there, they call across the aisle, is literally trying to dynamically balance that. You may always have a focus a little bit more on one pole than the other, okay? But it's your ability to know when you're going too far with one thing, how do you actually take that energy and balance that with the other energy in there, mm-hmm. And so some typical examples, another example is your inhale and your exhale. You can't have one without the other.
Right.
I want to focus on my inhale. Well, you have to focus on your exhale.
Yeah.
So there's a variety of different polarities that I see in sport. When I work with teams, I bring these up all the time and literally have the athletes on teams get together in small groups and identify. For example, I was working with Norwich men's lacrosse last year and Norwich men's lacrosse, women's hockey, and women's softball a year ago, January. Now, unfortunately, their seasons were cut short. Mm-hmm. But in the preparation for that, basically, they worked on a variety of different polarities that actually put together their strategic objectives for their team. So for one example in there, and coaches can see this too, is one polarity is called confidence and humility. Okay. For a coach, it's important to be confident. Okay. And there's an upside to being confident. Also an upside to showing humility there. And if you overfocus on showing confidence, the lack of humility, then players and athletes will see you as being arrogant. Okay. Right. So that's the downside. If you overfocus on humility to the neglect of confidence, there may be a level of meekness there. So it's getting the right balance that you have in there. Okay. Which is really, really important. A second one is automatic and reflective thinking. This is really interesting for players and coaches where our automatic thinking is around 80% of our day's focus on different things. We do things automatically. They're habituated. It's also called system one thinking. Okay. So for athletes, you really want to have athletes being in system one thinking out there. As a goalie, you don't want to think too much about your next save. Okay. You just follow the puck, because if you overthink, you go into system two, which is more deliberate and stuff like that. But then if you're doing that, you're not ready to actually make the save.
Yeah.
Getting to that sweet spot with that, and so for coaches to be able to balance it their lives, athletes to be able to balance in their lives. So there's times during practice to get more into system two thinking or reflective thinking. So you're really looking through new ways of doing things. Okay. And then system one thinking is once you get that down, you can actually do it habitually where you're not even thinking about it at all. It becomes almost unconscious. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, sometimes coaches and athletes may have developed some bad habits where when they're in system one, they're doing things that aren't working. Okay. Right. I think of a coach who told me about a high school coach, hockey coach about one of his athletes who took four penalties in a game. And because, wasn't able to control himself in certain types of situations. So they need to kind of go back to the drawing board and do some system two work and to kind of preface those situations and where those situations come up, where that athlete, that player gets in trouble with getting the penalties, and to practice that through. You know, it reminds me of a situation that I had once when I was coaching at the Culver Academies. And my claim to fame at Culver is that I coached them from 01 to 04. We won a couple state championships, which was exciting. But then we brought in a new coach afterwards, and I took a more of a minor role as an assistant coach with a team. And the team got really good when that happened. I mean, really good. And today they're a national high school power. But there's one of our players on the team had where his stick was too short. You have to have at least a 40-inch stick. Length of your stick, or it's illegal. And he was given a 3-minute unreleasable penalty, which that means is that for the next 3 minutes, the other team has an advantage by one player and has a man advantage. And even if they do score, you don't get the player back for 3 minutes.
Right.
So it's in the power play, the man up in lacrosse can be pretty deadly at times. So anyways, I saw that player look over at me and looked at me with incredible fear as if I was about to just lay right into him. And I caught myself, as I could feel my blood boil, because we had talked about this, take care of your equipment, okay? And I said, and he came over and I go, John, okay, here's the deal, okay? You made a mistake. I understand that. It wasn't good. It's a tough time to do that. But what I want you to do is to go into the penalty box, spend the first 30 seconds thinking about what happened, then spend the other two and a half minutes getting ready to get back out on that field with a new stick, because I need you out there. Mm-hmm. I need you out there. So it allowed for me, by practicing enough of this in system two thinking, that I was able to respond to him without a knee-jerk reaction. Mm. However, at times, people, players and coaches will respond with knee-jerk reactions if they're in HALTS, which is HALTS. That's an acronym that stands for being hungry, angry, lonely, tired, or stressed out. Okay? And when we get in those modes, we tend to act in system one. And if it's the action that needs to happen, that's good. But if it's something that we haven't worked through, then that's kind of an issue. So it's hitting that sweet spot with that, being able to not over-focus on one to the other, depending on where you are. Yeah. The third one that I see a lot with coaches is providing direction and empowering athletes. And so coaches can provide direction. They can find, and depending on the level and age appropriateness of the athletes and the teams, how much the coach provides direction is important. With kind of an elite team, there may be less direction provided and more empowering. For a youth team of an under 11 or a U-12 team, there may be more providing direction there. But it's also hitting that sweet spot with being able to empower the athlete by giving them some autonomy, some self-directedness, giving them voice and choice. So that becomes a dynamic balance. And in the book, we have a variety of polarity maps and exercises that the coaches actually can go through to actually see where they fit in there and to develop action steps to move forward out of that. So we kind of break it down, getting coaches to do that. The other one that I think is so important is individual and team. As I said before, there is an I in team. It's just when, if you think about focusing on the individual, when you have the individual focus, they're focusing on getting better, doing the things that they do well, being able to self-evaluate, etc. Being on a team, of course, brings in so many things, being on something larger than yourself, being part of a cohesive unit that you become a major part of that. You over-focus on being that individual to the neglect of the team, then you're going to be considered to be selfish. focusing on team to the neglect of the individual. Okay, and this doesn't happen that often, but there's always a point where sometimes the team becomes so important that an athlete could get lost in there and not perform as well. And we've seen this before where some athletes have wanted to make sure that they pass the puck or pass the ball where they should have taken it themselves. You know, that's the importance of dynamically balancing that. So this book deals a lot with polarity thinking, which has been used a lot in industry and business, not as much in sports. And so what I'm excited about is to share this with a lot of coaches to understand that and to actually, they'll begin to see that they actually use polarities. They may call them something different, you know, healthy tensions or paradoxes, but they can see ways and they can learn ways where they can, how they can make those shifts and how their actual players can and actually do polarity thinking and work on the strategic objectives for the team for that year.
Yeah, I really like that. When I was reading through the book about the many different examples, obviously you went through a few of them of the polarity thinking, it really kind of got me thinking the idea of you don't want to necessarily become rigid in one way because sports and life is too dynamic and too complex. So what you're really training yourself to do by being, first of all, you know, cognizant of the polarities and then being able to reflect and evaluate where you're at, but you're becoming adaptable to situations so that you can be versatile, say, you know, I don't have to be this coach archetype all the time because maybe that isn't optimal for me to get the most out of this player or in this situation. And so how can I become the best coach in all situations and how can I constantly adapt so that whatever adversity, whatever challenge, whatever circumstance is going on, I can get the best out of myself, my team, and individually and then collectively. I think it's just an incredible way of looking at it perhaps a little bit differently than what is maybe conventional.
Right. It's about both and thinking. Now there's either or thinking, who a coach may play, what you had for lunch. That's an either or decision. And there are a lot of either or decisions in coaching. But both and is because we're dealing with human dynamics and human behavior. There's always a shift. There's a shift in the team every year. Okay, right. That you are on that finished in 16 is the different than 17.
Right.
Okay, even though you only had a difference in, you know, you brought in, you know, new first-year players and you only graduated one other player, it's a different year, it's a different time, and the balance is different, so you have to look at things a little bit differently at that moment.
Right, and that obviously entails a lot of psych cap when you're trying to navigate those polarities because it is that human nature which is a little bit more complex and perhaps deeper than a simple either or. You know, for example, what am I eating for lunch? I mean, there's a necessarily a huge amount of hero elements, at least in my daily decisions of what I'm going to eat for lunch. But, you know, as opposed to, okay, if I'm looking at a polarity, for example, I love my favorite one that you talked about was automatic versus reflective thinking, that Daniel Kahneman, you know, system one, system two. I mean, trying to turn on from being, you want to be automated, you want to be dialed in, you want to be quick, but then you also have to know, when do I pause? When do I reflect? When am I deliberately analyzing and critiquing my own performance and that of others? And how do I learn and grow? It's just such a interesting dynamic. I love hearing you talk about this, and because you're pulling so many aspects, you're pulling aspects of experiential being a coach and a player. And you're talking about the aspects of leadership and, you know, values and how that drives. But then you're also talking about psychology. And I mean, there's so many elements that come together. It's such a wonderful kind of stir fry of information. And speaking of values, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that. And one of the things that I came across in your book was the idea of how values drive behavior, which is something I've seen a lot with, for example, Simon Sinek and Start With Why, which is a terrific read that I love that. And, you know, you talked about a terrific example. I'd love for you to share a little story with Travis Roy as well, who's a phenomenally inspiring individual. And just the idea of the polarity, I guess you could look at in many ways, of having values and having a greater purpose statement on one end of the spectrum. And then perhaps the other end is, what is your deeper fear, and trying to learn about yourself and how that drives you in a direction, whether that's as a coach or it could be anything in life.
Sure. Well, the greater purpose statement is when you're living in both the upsides of the polarities. If you're living in individual and team, and that's dynamically being balanced, the greater purpose statement might be, we all thrive individually and collectively. The deeper fear, okay, which is the opposite end of the spectrum, as you say, Braden, is when you're living in the downsides. If there's too much of an over-focus on the individual and and there was too much focus on the team. Okay, things aren't going that well for the team that's happening. Okay, and one deeper fear might be, and it's a provocative term, we don't survive. And the goal is in polarity thinking, is to really look at these provocative greater purpose and deeper fear statements out there that come alive to show, you know, what you value as the greater purpose and what's the worst case scenario that can happen if you're living in the downside of both. And you know, as you bring up the term, you know, talking about values and what people believe that are things that are important to them, that's so important, you know, with teams, with their core values. And I know core values are a term that's used all the time in sports and schools and industry, business. But the thing is, those become anchors, you know, and what those core values are, what are the behavioral anchors of those values of how we live are the mission of our organization. That's really, really important. It's a contract that's made up. And it gets back to what you were saying, that Simon Sinek talks about the why that leads the what and the how. And I think of Travis Roy, and Travis Roy was a collegiate hockey player, D1 at Boston University, I believe back in around 1995. I was teaching at BU at the time. And basically Travis was had a catastrophic injury in his first 11 seconds of his first college game, where he was skating into the dasher boards and he went to check a player and his actually head went into the dasher board and caused him to become a quadriplegic, where he had very little use of one of his hands. And one of the things that was amazing about Travis is his ability to be resilient. You talk about psychological capital. He was able to actually work through after coming out of the hospital and in therapy and stuff like that, actually was able to complete and finish his degree, his bachelor's at BU, and then actually began the Travis Roy Foundation, worked with, you know, individuals who had similar types of injuries or in typical types of situations. And so Travis, that what really struck me in one of the videos about him, first 20 years of my life, I had a passion, which was hockey. And for the next 20 years, I had a purpose, which was his foundation. And that's just, and unfortunately, Travis died recently, you know, in his 40s, which is just amazing that he was able to not survive, but flourish. Uh-huh. That we have a passion, that energy, that emotion that goes into something, but we also have a purpose, uh-huh, okay, of looking at something larger than self. And then actually, how do we balance our passion and purpose in the things that we do, in the way that we do them?
Yeah, it's such a powerful story every time, you know, I hear it or I read about it, and it's incredibly inspiring. And, you know, having been a hockey player and been in the Northeast for a long period of time, obviously I've been familiar about the Travis Roy Foundation for a long time, but I think that is super powerful. And, you know, it even gets me thinking today. I mean, I've started to, I don't want to ever say that I'm comparable to, you know, someone as inspiring as Travis Roy, but I remember, you know, at the same time when I was still playing hockey, so going up to a year ago, you know, I had a passion. I was in the same thing. I don't know if I really had a greater purpose other than I loved the game and I loved playing. But what was the bigger picture? What was I really doing to, you know, transform and serve other people and make the world a better place? I don't think I had that. I think that was missing, you know, and I've been trying to find my purpose and a deeper meaning for what my life is about and how I can contribute to people and what my core values are, you know. Like going back to Simon saying, start with why. What are your core values? Why does it matter? And then how do you drive that out? I think it's really important for people to take the time to consider that in their own life. And, you know, what are your passions and what are your purposes? What are your whys and how do you get there? And it's just incredibly inspiring every time. So I'm really glad you touched on that, because I think that matters in every context, whether you're a player or you're a coach, you're leading an organization, or you're trying to decide what you want for lunch that day. I mean, you know, understanding values is critical to everything, right?
Yeah. And it's okay to have it's okay to have purpose in hockey too. Mm. It's not that it has to be outside of that. It can be any place, you know, that, but to show that those are two dynamic pieces helps to, for people to be fully functioning. And I think it's really essential and critical for coaches to be aware of what their passion is, okay, and what their purpose is and what they do.
Right. Okay. So to kind of keep this going a little bit, I want to talk a little bit more specific about actually coaching and how, and some examples of some coaches that are fantastic. And in your book, you pull on a ton of different coaches who are doing some amazing things, and you have some great quotes. And the first person I want to talk about is, she came up a lot in the book. Her name is Catherine DeLorenzo. Hopefully I said that right. She's the women's field hockey coach at Middlebury. And I just want to quickly read a few of her quotes, and I'd love for you to talk a little bit about her, because I was blown away by all of her stuff. So first of all, the first quote that I really loved, "I want them to really feel that they matter to each other. They feel relevant." And so this is the idea of talking about relevancy and appraisal within players and how you can, in many ways, you're empowering your players. The second quote that I really loved and kind of builds off that as well. She says, "When you feel known, you feel relevant. When you feel relevant, you're motivated to contribute." And I love that, because it really just hits home with people, right? That's really what coaching and what leadership is about, is you are trying to empower someone to take their own initiative and then to be their best version. You're not telling them to do something, you're enabling them. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about Catherine, because obviously I don't know her personally, but blown away by all the excerpts and stories and examples and quotes you have in the book. So I'd love for you to just start off with her.
Well, Catherine, in her tenure as Middlebury's field hockey coach, has had a multiple national, Division III national championships in field hockey. But one of the things that really struck me in my interview with her, and I believe the interview was probably spent, we probably spent 90 minutes. And I taped her on this and I was just really kind of blown away by her thoughtfulness about the power of empowering her athletes, and that to get them to feel relevant. And when she talks about getting to have them known, it's not knowing, you know, what your where you're from, what your astrological sign and what your major is. It's really having players to get to know each other. And that is almost a criteria. It is a criteria for being part of that team. So in many ways, there's not a nanosecond of doubt when it comes to whether an athlete's going to pass the ball or not, because the athletes know each other so well. They know each other's moves out there. They know how each other thinks. Thing is that to get known is to feel relevant, okay, that they matter to the situation. And the term matter, I believe, is so important. And Catherine talks a lot about what she calls the scope of contribution. And what is the athlete's scope of contribution? I remember in part of the interview, and I put this in the book, where she had one athlete who really basically didn't see the time very much, maybe a couple minutes a year on the field, but is so valuable in practice and other things going on with the team that her scope of contribution is really powerful towards that. So she may not have that skill level to be playing a lot there, is these other things. And she said to me, you could talk to this young woman, and she would tell her that this is my scope of contribution. I love this team. I love being part of it. And, you know, of course people want to get playing time. Okay. But the thing is that she has set this up in such a way that the scope of contribution is understood by each one of her athletes, you know. And then also part of feeling relevant is that if it's at halftime, break, and something isn't going well, she'll ask the players, what do you think's going on here? And so one player would say to her, you know, I think when we tried this against Bates, it kind of worked. Maybe we should try this again. She goes, that's a really good idea. You know, let's go with that. And imagine how that allows for a player to feel.
Right, right.
So there's no longer, you know, there's power differential, you know, with coach and player in this situation is almost non-existent. She's still the coach. They're still the athletes, the players. Okay. But the bottom line is they feel relevant. They feel that they matter. And I talk about this in chapter 5 of the book, and called Cultivating Connections. I use the term now. I didn't have it in the book, called EMT. So not emergency medical technician, but empathy, mattering, and trust. Okay, as three critical pieces there, okay, that are happening with her teams. year in, year out.
Right.
You know, and she had talked to me about coming to work with her team. And it's about working with her team. It's not about trying to get an extra win in there. It's about building them and helping them grow as human beings.
That's amazing. And I love so much the idea of matter. And this brings me to the next person, which is the Norwich University men's lacrosse coach, Neil Anderson, who I've actually built up a relationship with recently. And I've been on the phone with him many times. And I love his approach to coaching and to the world and to life. And I think he is a brilliant, brilliant mind. And one thing that we spent a lot of time talking about together is the concept of the human ego. And how do we then transcend that? How do we understand people and build relationships and use tactical empathy, for example, like Chris Voss's work, and understand people to empower them? And one thing that he has said to me repeatedly, so this may not be an exact quote, but I'm pretty sure I've heard him say this repeatedly, is that each person has an underlying desire to be appreciated and understood. In other words, they want to feel like they matter, which is exactly then what Catherine DiLorenzo was doing. And, you know, I know he has worked really hard to incorporate that into his coaching, and his team's had a ton of success. And I know guys that have played for him on the Norwich lacrosse team as well that absolutely love him as a coach. And so you've had a chance to talk with him as well. And I'd love for you to share a little bit about what you think makes him such a great coach and having so much success, and the way that he pulls aspects of psychological capital and, you know, everything that the coaching zone is all about into what he does.
Well, I remember in January of 2020, kind of coming over, you know, coming from being in Middlebury and coming over to Norwich. You know, I'd worked with the Middlebury teams and came and, you know, and it was kind of got there early. So we had this 3-hour piece of time before I was going to work with the team, the Norwich men's lacrosse team. And I just sat down and went to school and just listened to him talk about his thought process with tactical empathy, Chris Voss's work, and other aspects of really understanding and appreciating athletes. And it was just really, really powerful. It's just like, yeah, that's it. And that's why they love him and they love playing. They're similar to Catherine DiLorenzo at Middlebury, you know, and that he does a really good job at effectively challenging his athletes day by day, where he'll try something else. His fellow coach will kind of just step back and just let some things happen. Mm-hmm. Even though the player may want some feedback right away, and Neil might say, hey, let's go try it out, see how it works.
Yeah.
The athlete might say, what's the answer to this? Well, try it out and see how it works. So he gets the athletes to fish for themselves.
Right.
Okay. And he uses the feedback when it's most appropriate at the right time. So he's really good at giving, three types of feedback, which is I take from the work that Stone and Heehan have done in their book, Thanks for the Feedback. He gives, you know, like appreciation feedback, giving thanks, okay, for things, you know, recognizing athletes. But he's also really good at skill improvement or coaching feedback, the second type of feedback there too. And the third is that he's really good at evaluation feedback. So when saying, you know, you were successful in 60% of those clears as a team, or, you know, 70% of face-offs. That's evaluation feedback. It's critical in giving feedback to other people, especially if it's critical feedback, that it's done at the right time for the right person for the right reason.
Right.
It's got to be the right type of feedback. Or some people are given evaluative feedback and they really need coaching feedback there. Neil is amazing with that. You know, to allow for that to happen. You know, he understands that, you know, and brings that out in his players and in, you know, everything that he does with them. So he lets them to try to figure out new ways of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that does that becomes contagious with some of the other players on the team.
I also love the way he likes to use open-ended questions, and he kind of prompts you to come up with your solutions. And I know one example that he loves talking about, what every time that I've talked to him, is Stephen Kotler's work on flow state and the idea of trying to do the impossible. I know Stephen Kotler's come out with a new book, The Art of Impossible. And he loves the way to frame questions so that the players can take initiative. So for example, let's say there was a practice, you know, and it was alumni weekend or something. And, you know, they had to go to drill right after, or they had morning class and X, Y, and Z, and, you know, all these things going on. And, you know, it was bad weather or whatever. And instead of being, okay, guys, you know, let's try and have a really good practice today. You know, the way he would phrase that type of statement was, is it impossible for us to have our best practice of the year today? And I remember the first time I heard him say something like that, it's like, no, I guess not. And then, you know, it kind of gets you thinking in a different way. And he's just, he's very tactical with his language. And I think it's wonderful to listen to him. So I had the same experience. The first time I talked with him, we'd planned for maybe just an hour on Zoom, and it ended up going much longer than that before we had to finally shut it down, you know, but he's a guy you could talk about for a long period of time. So I love that you included him in the book as well, because I think his work is awesome. Now, in for the sake of time, I want to skip ahead a little bit. And I want to quickly talk about 360 degree strengths gallery. And this is something that we did at Norwich when you came in and worked with us in the old Kreitzberg library. And I'd love for you to just quickly maybe talk about what it is and why it works. Then I can share a little bit about how I experienced it. And then we can kind of head into the conclusion of our talk.
Part of athlete self-awareness and team self-awareness is for athletes to look at their strengths and kind of their blind spots or shortcomings. And many times there can be a negativity bias where people can actually focus more on their negatives than their positives. So we typically have athletes take a strengths inventory, whether it's the values in action via strengths inventory or strengths finder 2.0. And out of that, they get to look at, you know, what are the things, what are their assets, what are their strengths that they see in themselves. What the strengths 360 strengths gallery is taking taking your strengths, but then also going in, looking at predicting or guesstimating the strengths of other players on your team without already knowing that, seeing their list. So basically what happens is players will have a sheet of paper, a template with everybody's name will be written down on it. And next to that, you'll have the list of strengths descriptions, whether it's the 24 via descriptions or the 35 strength finders 2.0 descriptions. And then you actually write one or two or three different strengths that you see in that person. You write it down on that list. And then each player, if you can imagine, visualize this, that each player on the team has a half a sheet of sticky easel paper, and they put that up on the wall all the way around. So you picture all the way around the room, team room, or we were doing in the Kreitzberg library. Okay. And then with a marker, you write on the top of it your name. And then when you're there and in front of your sheet. And then what you do is you go, you know, you go one step clockwise to the next sheet. And that's where the exercise continues. And then what you do is you write down the strengths of that person that are on that next sheet. You've already done it there. You've already written them down. So you run that down there and you continue going around till you end up back at your same spot again. Now, if somebody has more than one strength that's in frequency there, then you just put a check mark. So we've seen before people will have like 5, 6, 7 check marks next to their name that they really know that person that they see there. And then what happens is then, typically breaking into some smaller groups, okay, and then actually go through each athlete, and players within that group tell 2, 3, or 4 different anecdotes or stories of why they think that strength comes alive for that person. Mm-hmm. So it allows for more of an intimate understanding of this is what I see in you. Mm-hmm. So the athlete or player says, this is how I see myself in the world. This is how my teammates see me. And it's sometimes athletes feel, you know, very self-conscious about having somebody say something so nice to them. Mm-hmm. You know, and sometimes they're not even aware that they had that strength. Once they're told by somebody else, now they have it. They own it now in their lives. I remember doing this with one team once where a woman began to cry, a player, began to cry when we went through that. And you know, there weren't tears of joy there. And so I went up because part of my job as a facilitator is to make sure that this is a safe environment. And I asked her, are you okay? What's going on? She goes, well, nobody has ever said anything like this to me, positive ever. And this is the first time. And it feels good, but it felt bad that it happened before. That became a whole view of strategic objectives and polarity work that we went into with the team afterwards. Mm-hmm. Really help to work and make this team work well. Mm-hmm. You know, so the strengths piece really, it creates overall in most cases should create a space, safe space there too, you know, that allows for this to happen there. And it's a typical exercise that most teams really enjoy doing that.
Yeah, and I can speak from experience. I thought it was probably one of the most powerful team building experiences that we ever had in our 4 years at Norwich. And I remember, like you said, it really opens up an intimate space. And, you know, okay, yeah, you spend every day with your teammates. You're in the locker room. You're in the dorm rooms. You see them every day. But you're not necessarily vulnerable or being emotional or opening those doors to let's have a more intimate conversation about how we perceive each other, how we value each other, and how we fit into this collective. Because, and I guess perhaps maybe it's part of the nature of competitive athletics where you have a lot of type A personalities and you show up, you do your job and you carry on, you know, and, you know, everyone has to be macho or, you know, oh, there's no, you know, no time for the soft emotional, let's be honest and tell each other how we feel. But it is so important to build that intimacy. And I remember going around and it keeps bringing me back to the idea of the human ego and Neil Anderson, that everyone has a desire to feel appreciated and understood. And I know for me, I had a high level of self-confidence, you know, in my own life and in what I brought to the team and how I felt I positioned myself. But seeing that, you know, on that sheet and other people write down strengths that they see in me in the check marks, that was very, very powerful for me. And that was just a huge confidence boost and this huge kind of just this reassurance saying, you know, you do belong here. You do have value. Keep doing what you're doing. And it's just this huge motivation factor. But the most powerful part was actually when you get into those small groups and you have someone look you in your eyes and say, this is something that I thought about, or this was something that you did previously. Maybe that, you know, we have our blinders on and we don't really take the time to think about it. And you realize that, okay, maybe I did have a positive impact. And then you have the opportunity to share things you notice with other people. And you can see it in someone's emotions and in their reaction, that it genuinely impacts them and makes them feel better and makes them feel empowered. And I know, you know, a lot of the guys on the team, obviously I can't speak for everyone because I didn't go to everyone's dorm rooms or to their houses, but I know lots of guys still had them up either in their dorm rooms, you know, for the rest of the year, or keep them, you know, somewhere safe and stash away and refresh them. Sometimes you need, you know, you're in a little bit of a funk. It's a long season. You know, that's normal. Life is hard. It's some cold, dark winters in Vermont too. And you got school going on. And sometimes you just need to pull up that sheet of paper and see, you know, at least as part of the team, because you're essentially, you know, a brotherhood or a family, you know,
sure.
23 brothers that I have, or sisters, you know, depending on your team, that the closest people in my closest relationships here in this team and at school, you know, they think this of me, they remember that story. And, you know, it's such a powerful experience. And I, you know, after that experience too, I really, really recall feeling that the locker room, It's hard to quantify. It's almost ineffable, but it did feel like it was closer, like it was tighter, like we were even more in sync as one single cohesive unit. And, you know, sure enough, as we were doing this stuff, that goes back to what I'd mentioned earlier, talking about when we won that national championship was Hero, where I had never been part of a single unit, a single cohesive unit that was so dialed in with the elements of hope, efficacy or confidence, resilience and optimism. And I do think this was an important part of it. And it was just such a great experience that you brought to our team that, you know, I would never have crossed my mind of the idea of, hey, let's look at, you know, our strengths and tell each other about it. You know, it's a wonderful thing. So I'm really glad you do that. I think, you know, anyone that's interested in learning more should definitely reach out to you and see how, you know, they can implement that in their organizations, whatever organization that is.
Yeah, exactly. It has, you know, I've done this with, the C-suite with corporations before. It can be used with almost any environment, with any organization.
Yeah, I love that. So before we get into the final question where I want to ask you for your advice for people, I would just first like to ask you, John, where can people find you? Where can they learn more about Jaeger Leadership Group, about all of your books, and especially The Coaching Zone, which we've talked about a lot today? And if they, you know, want to learn more, they want to reach out to you and get some help with their teams and organizations, where can people find you? Where can they learn more? Anything you want to plug in?
Well, my email is john@jaegerleadership.com, Jaeger Leadership. Two websites. One is jaegerleadership.com. And then the new, for the new book, it's the coachingzonebook.com. Mm. Coachingzonebook.com. Those are three different ways to get in touch with me, or to, you know, to read a little bit more about some of the things that I can support and partner with an organization. with. And right now the we're looking at that launch coming out in either late March or early April. It'll depend, you know, when this airs, the book.
Yeah, I think we're going to be timing it out really nice. And I'll make sure that I put all of those in the show notes and on the website as well. So if people are looking up, they can find the coachingzonebook.com, JaegerLeadership.com, and then John at JaegerLeadership.com as well for your email, I believe. But I'll make sure I get it correctly when I post it and share it. So the final thing, what I love everyone I talk to, and I love to ask them, my show, Learn to Perform, I'm really trying to help people optimize their health, their happiness, and their performance. So I would love for you to share your advice for people optimizing their health, their happiness, and performance. And obviously you have a lot of history and experience and expertise on so many different aspects of life. So I'd love to hear what your pieces of advice are for people.
I think, Braden, it goes back to some of the things that I talked about earlier. It's about having a really strong level of self-awareness, you know, about how we see ourselves in the world that we're in, and to make a difference that we can end up making a difference, not just with ourselves, but with other people. But self-awareness, self-regulation, and then the third is self-compassion. Okay, and to be able to take care of ourselves and not use generous understanding with ourselves instead of being overly judgmental. And I think during COVID, it's been probably even in a greater time where self-awareness, self-regulation, and self-compassion have come in this past year. Very, very important. Regarding to optimize happiness, I think of the acronym PERMA, P-E-R-M-A, and this was coined by the guru of positive psychology, Martin Seligman, from the University of Pennsylvania. He stands for positive emotions. Okay. Mm-hmm. We have negative emotions, but it's really important that we show our positive emotions too. Positive emotions. Secondly, R is for relationships. Okay. Okay. E, I forgot in the middle there, is engagement. So it's positive emotions, engaging others, engagement, relationships. M is for meaning, and A is achievements. And looking at that mantra and how that fits, and to see how people can live an authentically happy life, is to really look and identify with those five different characteristics. And one thing to optimize performance, I would say, is developing a collective aspects of PsyCap. You know, it's developing a way that we can use hope in our setting of goals, our pathways to get there, in our agency and achieving them. Or secondly, is our efficacy or confidence that we have the capacity to learn new experiences and master them through mastering our former experiences. Okay. Third is that resilience and, you know, the capacity to bounce back, but not even just bounce back, but bounce forward. Is looking, if we have negative belief systems that do come up, how can we reject some of those negative belief systems and bring in frames that actually work for us in our life? And fourth is realistic optimism or optimism that allows us to we have our leniency for the past, not being judgmental, too judgmental, appreciating the present, and having opportunities for the future. This is work that's Sandra Schneider has done at the University of South Florida.
Wow, I love those. That's a super thorough answer. So I'm going to quickly recap, because I took some notes here for the people listening in case they didn't catch all that. To optimize health, self-awareness, self-compassion, and self-regulation, which I think are phenomenal. And boy, has that really become evident this year. You definitely hit the nail on your head with that one. And then happiness is PERMA, which is positive emotions, engagement, relationships, meaning, and accomplishments. And then, of course, something we have touched about a lot for performance is PsyCap. And so we go back to HERO, which is hope. And then there's the efficacy or confidence, resilience, and then realistic optimism. So, John, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I've learned so much out of this, and I've taken so much out of reading The Coaching Zone, which I thank you again for the early look, but also, you know, with our time, I remember it fondly at Norwich University. It was in those brief little moments that had a major impact on me and our team and everyone. I mean, you know, who's to say whether or not that was the difference between winning a national championship or not, but it was definitely a contributing factor. And I know for every person that was a part of that organization, that that's going to be a highlight forever. So I can't thank you enough for what you're doing.
Thank you. And you know, you work there at Norwich as a player and then eventually as a co-captain there. It's just that my opportunity to work with Norwich really fed me a lot too. It allows me to learn and to grow too. So it's a dynamic balance in there.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. There's a little give and take. Perhaps maybe that's a little bit of a polarity as well. Throw in to wrap it up. Okay. Well, John, thank you so much for your time. I'm super excited to share this with everyone. You've got a ton of great stuff to share, and I hope that people, you know, enjoy it, get some value out of it, and get in touch if they have any questions or need to learn more.
That's great. Thanks, Braden.
To discover more, this episode with all citations is available on the website, and you can also contact me on social media with any questions or comments. If you found this episode useful or think that it may help someone else, I encourage you to pass it along. Thank you all for joining me on this journey to lifelong health, happiness, and higher performance. And remember, always be grateful, love yourself, and serve others.